This is episode 53 of Beyond the Bulletin. Hello and welcome to episode 53 of Beyond the Bulletin. I'm Brandon Sweet, editor of the Daily Bulletin.
And from Media Relations, I'm Pamela Smythe.
We're coming to you from our homes where we're practicing physical distancing. Thank you for joining us as we go Beyond the Bulletin.
And like we've done every week, we'll talk about some of the top stories featured in the Daily Bulletin, and then we're going to look ahead to see what's on the horizon, both inside and outside Ring Road.
Mostly outside Ring Road these days. We'll also take the opportunity to speak with Waterloo people and personalities about key issues that matter.
Later, Will Percival, Distinguished Research Chair in Astrophysics, will tell us about the massive research project he helped lead that resulted in the largest ever 3D map of the universe. And I will add that Will was here previously in episode 19, way back with the launch of the Waterloo Center for Astrophysics.
I always enjoy a return visitor. Welcome back, Will.
I'm just nostalgic, so I like looking back.
Oh, I'd be nothing if without nostalgia.
And with that,
here's what's been happening. Well, once again, for the University of Waterloo, the sky's the limit and space is the place.
Astrophysicists, including researchers from the University of Waterloo, have filled in 11 billion years in our picture of the universe with the release of a comprehensive analysis of the largest three-dimensional cosmic map ever created.
Billions and billions and billions. Space really is the final frontier, but we won't give away too much of the story now. Be sure to keep listening for Pamela's interview with Professor Will Percival, who is also an associate faculty member at the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics. And now for something completely different. What do Batman, Zorro, Michael Myers, Darth Vader, Jason Voorhees, and Iron Man all have in common?
They're all the subject of highly lucrative movie franchises spanning decades?
Well, yes, but they're also famous for wearing a particular article of clothing that is now going to be mandatory on the University of Waterloo campus starting July 27th.
Oh, they wear masks. But Batman and Zorro's masks aren't protective, Brandon. They just go over their eyes.
Yes, that's exactly the opposite, but we'll get to that. President Ferdinand Hamdallapur circulated a memo to employees and graduate students earlier this week that announced the university's plans for mandatory face coverings as part of its overall safe, phased return to campus initiative.
Effective Monday, July 27th, all employees, students, visitors, and contractors are required to wear a face covering in common use areas of university buildings. As the president's memo goes, this includes corridors, lobbies, washrooms, elevators, and meeting rooms, or in any area where physical distancing is a challenge. Where you can establish and maintain a physical distance of 2 meters, you can remove your mask.
So in this context, a face covering...
I'm going to pull my face right off like somebody in Scooby-Doo.
Scooby-Doo? Hey, it's Mr. Withers, the caretaker of the haunted theme park.
You meddling kids.
So, in this context, a face covering is defined as a medical or non-medical mask or other covering, including a bandana, scarf, or other fabric that covers the nose, mouth, and chin to create a barrier to limit the transmission of respiratory droplets.
So sorry, Batman and Zorro. Better put masks on the lower half of your face instead. Well, what if they just want to be mysterious?
I think you can be plenty mysterious with the mask on the bottom half of your face.
I go into the supermarket and I got my sunglasses still on and my mask. I look like I'm trying to hide from the paparazzi. Okay, so this measure helps the university align with the recent Region of Waterloo bylaw making face coverings mandatory in indoor public spaces and follows evidence-based public health advice, which we should always do.
Yes. And of course, there are some exceptions to the university's mask mandate. The requirement to wear a mask does not apply to people who are unable to wear a mask due to a medical condition or disability, to children under the age of 5, to people who are hearing impaired or when communicating with a person who is hearing impaired and the ability to see the mouth is essential for communication, or when wearing a face covering would create a risk to the wearer related to their work as determined by workplace safety guidelines.
Masks are not required in situations where you can maintain a physical distance of 2 meters between you and other people. Additionally, in teaching environments, instructors can use their discretion to decide whether masks are needed based on the physical layout of the room, course activities, and their own comfort. In work settings, managers will set the expectation with their teams based on physical setup and work activities.
So students, faculty, and staff are allowed to wear their own masks that they've purchased or made or otherwise acquired, if they so choose. But managers and researchers are also able to order cloth face masks from central stores using central stores' online stores requisition form free of charge. Although you'll still have to input an account number for order tracking purposes.
Additionally, as we reported in last week's episode, Waterloo branded cloth masks are available for purchase at the W Store. If you can't wear a face mask for any of the reasons that we just mentioned, and you want to learn about an alternative, please contact Occupational Health.
You can read the full text of the president's memo on the university's COVID-19 website, where you can also get more information and review the list of frequently asked questions.
Moving on, last week, the Orientation Steering Committee and Chris Reed, the Associate Provost students, issued an update on fall 2020 orientation for incoming students.
To complement the pre-arrival Waterloo-ready virtual programming, first-year orientation will begin earlier than normal. It will take place this year from September 1st to the 7th, the week before classes start. In his memo to campus, Chris Reed notes that this date shift ensures that orientation programming will not compete with other priorities and demands that students will experience during the first week of classes as they attempt to set up their online courses and get all of that stuff straightened out.
Programming will focus on connecting students with their future classmates, sharing the unique traditions of the faculties, and sharing more about student life at Waterloo. It will include traditional programming such as Warrior Welcome, Dear First Year Me, and the International Student Welcome.
For incoming graduate students, the Waterloo Grad Ready program will replace the traditional campus-wide graduate orientation program.
You can find more information about these programs in the Daily Bulletin from July 17th and also on the orientation website.
All right. Well, it is clear to me that we haven't used the phrase innovation or the word innovation enough lately in the podcast. So we are going to fulfill our quota by moving on to a story about the virtual Waterloo Innovation Summit that was held on Wednesday, July 22nd.
Yeah, I think there might be a fine if we don't say innovation enough.
Yes, we're contractually obligated. So this first ever virtual Waterloo Innovation Summit, or WIS, was actually entitled Reset, Rebuild, Rebound, the Talent Imperative, and was part of the speaker, or is the latest part of the speaker series that was relaunched earlier this year. In an article featured in the Daily Bulletin earlier this week, Sandra Banks, our Vice President University Relations, explored the important role of the university in connecting emerging talent to employers, especially in a post-COVID world. Banks cited Randall Lane, Chief Content Officer and Editor with Forbes, who sees universities playing the pivotal role at the nexus of public-private innovation initiatives, as employers benefit from highly motivated and knowledgeable teams of talented students.
Randall Lane was the keynote speaker and panel moderator at this week's event.
Noting that Canada's economy needs a resilient and future-ready workforce that will drive the country's recovery, Banks said that the University of Waterloo has increased hiring flexibility and opportunities for employers to access funding to hire students as part of the university's wider response to the changing needs of the Canadian workforce. She went on to explore how companies like ApplyBoard and Vidyard are adapting to digital environments and harnessing workplace data and insights to attract the next generation of talent.
Speakers at the summit included Martin Basiri, co-founder and CEO of ApplyBoard and Deloitte 2019 Technology Fast 50 winner, Michael Litt, co-founder and CEO of Vidyard and Canada's Top 40 Under 40 2019, Nora McRae, Associate Provost, Cooperative and Experiential Education at Waterloo, Charmaine Dean, Vice President, Research and Innovation, and as we've mentioned before, Sandra Banks, who delivered the opening and closing remarks.
You can read the article in the Daily Bulletin from July 20th, and the Waterloo Innovation Summit's video recording will be available on the university's YouTube channel.
This week's event is the first part of a two-part series. The second virtual Waterloo Innovation Summit is scheduled for August 19th. It will feature Randall Lane as keynote speaker and moderator.
Now, here's what's coming up. We now know the names of the Spring 2020 Concept 5K finalists. 10 student-led teams working on projects they hope to turn into the next big startup will compete for early-stage funding on Tuesday, July 28th. These students came from a pool of more than 80 applicants and impressed a panel of judges at the Concept 5K semifinals to secure their place in the finals. Each team will produce a 3-minute pitch video outlining what they're working on and why it shows great promise, and then prove that they're deserving of that $5,000 grant.
The finalists are Aquacell Energy, Citrus, Cloud Safari Inc., 8 Stories of Modesty, Lumos, Mox Health, Autofollow, Scribble, Waitlist, and ViterDB. 8 Stories of Modesty is a hijab brand that aims to create a meaningful journey for customers by bringing to light the experiences of women who wear the headscarf.
Very interesting. So this term's Concept 5K Finals will once again be held online. The finalists' 3-minute pitch videos will be uploaded to Concept's YouTube channel, and the panel of judges will gather and view each team's videos before ultimately selecting the top 4 and crowning winners of the Spring 2020 Concept 5K Finals. Follow Concept's social media accounts to remain part of the pitch competition's virtual audience, and vote for the People's Champ Award. You can read more about the teams and the competition on Concept's website. And now the interview. As part of the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, a team of scientists just released an image of the largest 3D map of the universe. And one of those scientists is Will Percival. He's a Waterloo professor and the director of the Waterloo Center for Astrophysics at the University of Waterloo, where he holds the Mike and Ophelius Lazaridis Distinguished Chair in Astrophysics. He's also an associate faculty member at the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics. He helped lead this massive project, and here is his conversation with Pamela about its significance and what's next.
Welcome back, Will.
Thank you.
So the largest ever 3D map of the universe. This is one of, as I read, this is one of the substantial advances in cosmology in the past 10 years. Can you tell me why that is?
So from a map of the universe, we get a whole wealth of cosmological information. Basically, the galaxies that we use to trace the universe are not distributed randomly. They cluster in patterns, they cluster along filaments, in sheets. There are voids where there are no galaxies. And this pattern and how we see it tell us a great deal of cosmological information. So one of the techniques we use is to use the pattern of galaxies as a standard ruler. Basically, there's a preferred scale in the separation of galaxies. We tend to find more galaxies separated by a particular distance. And we can find this in our survey. And what it does is it forms a standard ruler. Once we've got this standard ruler in the universe, we can measure the expansion rate. Now, this standard ruler is very, very robust. It's a really great technique for measuring the expansion rate really precisely. Now, what happens is when we have a galaxy survey, we're covering such distances that as we look back at these distant galaxies, the amount of time it's taken the light to reach us matters, and it matters hugely. So as we're looking back in our map, we're actually looking back in time. And so our standard ruler isn't just telling us about the geometry of the universe at the present day. It's telling us about how the universe has evolved over the time it's taken that light to reach us. And in fact, our galaxy survey is so big that we're looking back 11 billion years into the past. Now, the universe is only 13.7 billion years old. So we're looking back over most of the time in the universe. And that means we've got this history of the universe. We know how it has expanded and evolved. Now, the exciting thing is that the expansion of the universe is not actually happening as we might expect it. If the universe was only composed of regular matter and gravity was acting on it. Because we know that the universe has expanded since the Big Bang, but we also know that gravity is an attractive force. Gravity tends to pull things together and it tends to slow down the expansion rate of the universe. But what we see in this map, and other experiments have shown this as well, is that actually the current expansion rate of the universe is accelerating. The universe is getting bigger and bigger, faster and faster. And that just goes contrary to modern physics. It's one of these things where we have found something that we don't understand. People have given it a name. They've called it dark energy. But as you know, naming something, it doesn't actually give you understanding of what it is. So we're in this really exciting phase of physics where these kinds of observations have told us there's something in the universe that we don't understand. Now, the really embarrassing thing is that this dark energy, it must be composed of 70% of the energy density at present day. So when I say energy density of the universe, what I mean is just the material in the universe. So it's not just that there's something in the universe we don't understand. It's actually the majority of the universe that we don't understand. And that's what's so exciting. Now, coming back to the map tells us this information. It doesn't just tell us this information. Once we have a map of galaxies, it's like a gold mine of information. That distribution of galaxies, it tells us a whole wealth of different physical processes. As well as measuring the expansion rate, one of the things we can get from the galaxies is the growth of structure within the universe. Not only can we tell how quickly the universe is expanding, but we can also see how quickly material is growing in it. So on small scales, gravity does win out, as we know, because we're living on the Earth is a bound system, it must have come together sometime in the past. In fact, we think the Earth formed 4 billion years ago, well within the time it's taken the light to reach us. So the light from the distant galaxies set off way before the Earth was formed.
Hmm.
So we see this growth of structure. And one of the things we've done from EBOS is look at this growth of structure. And just by looking at the growth of structure, we can also see that the growth of structure on very large scales slows down because of dark energy. And that means we've got multiple tests of this, you know, new phenomena within the data set.
Now, you mentioned EBOS. That's the Extended Baryon Oscillation Spectroscopic Survey.
Correct.
How does that relate to the Sloan Digital Sky Survey?
So the Sloan Digital Sky Survey is kind of like an umbrella organization, and it covers many different projects, and it's covered many different projects over the last 20 years. EBOS has been happening for the last 5 years. It's the latest in a series of deep galaxy surveys performed with the Sloan Foundation Telescope and under the umbrella of the SDSS organization. The exciting thing about EBOS is that we're pushing to higher redshifts, further distances than we've pushed to previously with other galaxy surveys, which means we're covering a larger volume of the universe. So we're looking back to further look back times. Basically, we're looking back further into the history of the universe. And it gives us, together with other experiments that have been done, one of them was called BOSS, the Baryon Oscillation Spectroscopic Survey, of which we're an extension. So these together give us this view of the whole 11 gigayears of history, right from the nearby universe, what's happening now, through to the distant universe, which tells us what was happening 11 gigayears in the past.
I thought I heard you use the word embarrassing. Did you say something was embarrassing about this?
Yes.
What could possibly be embarrassing?
Well, it's not the results per se. It's what they mean for physics. So this idea that we don't understand 70% of the material in the universe, I think that's embarrassing. It's maybe it shouldn't be embarrassing. Maybe it should just be good that there is stuff out there in the universe that we don't understand. I think it's great that there is stuff we don't understand. But as physicists, our job is to understand things. And we're saying, well, we don't understand 70% of the universe. So we need to rectify this. And in fact, the surveys like EBOS, they've shown this is definitely a problem. Our evidence now is incredibly significant.
Mm-hmm.
And the next generation of surveys, obviously, we've been very successful. That means there will be future surveys. They will be bigger and better. They're going to larger telescopes. They're going for larger spectrographs. They will be able to observe more galaxies. And they are tasked with answering the question of what is dark energy. They're going to be trying to get the information that we need to go from a detection of it through to a, this is the detailed look at what it's actually doing. This is what it has to be.
Would you say that the biggest surprise was about the expansion rate of the universe?
We've kind of known that the current expansion rate is accelerating for about 20 years now from other experiments. We now have the best evidence for it and the best information of it to date. It's still not quite enough to say what it is. In terms of what was most interesting, exciting, perhaps it's that our results do still match the standard picture. We were hoping for anomalies. In fact, what we found is that the expansion rate and the rate of growth, they all match Einstein's cosmological constant. Now, there are some really interesting results that if we compare what we've measured in detail to other measurements, particularly of the current expansion rate, so not its acceleration, but just how quickly is the universe expanding at present day. You can do this with the kind of galaxy survey that we do, looking back in time and fitting a model. You can also try to measure it directly by taking a distance to a galaxy, nearby galaxy, measuring its redshift, which gives you its velocity, and then comparing the velocity to the distance. And you can try to do that locally to look at the current expansion rate. And if we do that, we actually get different values. Now, people initially thought this might be because something interesting was happening in the local universe. In general, our results have not agreed with this. What we find in the local universe is that everything's behaving according to this standard picture. If this isn't just a problem with some data set, then possibly the answer lies in the very early universe. If some of the physics there went a little bit differently, we can just about reconcile these two experimental results.
How did the team come up with this 3D map?
As with all science, this is building on the shoulders of giants. That we didn't just wake up one morning and say, hey, let's do a galaxy survey. And everybody goes, hey, that's a cool idea. you know, every experiment is driven by instrumentation. It's the development of that instrumentation that drives the experiment. With the Sloan Telescope, for 20 years, it's been at the cutting edge of multi-object spectroscopy, that is, taking the spectra of many objects at any point. It's quite remarkable that a relatively small telescope, the Sloan Foundation Telescope, has a 2.5-meter diameter primary mirror. It might sound large, it's bigger than you could fit in your backyard, but it, you know, modern astronomical telescopes, they're 10 meters across to do cutting edge science on individual objects. So it's relatively small. So we're driven by instrumentation. This instrumentation was developed. It's got better. Our analysis have got better. Our pipelines have got better. And about 5 years ago, we realized that we could actually use this relatively small telescope to make a galaxy survey out to higher redshifts than had previously been done, and hence EBOS was formed.
So the most important part of this, though, you've said, isn't about the map.
I've done a number of interviews on the past couple of days, and a number of people have asked me, do you look at this map? What do you think when you look at the map? And I'm like, I hardly ever actually just look at the map, because the exciting thing for me is in the analysis of it. And you can't see all of the information there just by looking at the map. You have to do a careful, detailed statistical analysis. The data is converted into files, it's run through pipelines, and then out pops, you know, a plot that you can then interpret. So it's the exciting thing for me is seeing those plots, not necessarily seeing the data itself.
Right. So it's not, I mean, it's a cool picture. Sells the story.
to be honest with you, putting together this press release has been really nice, because we have been able to put together the sort of publicity shots that show the picture and show the universe. And we can, you know, occasionally take a couple of minutes to sit back and go, actually, yeah, it is quite cool.
The release of this map came with the simultaneous release of 23 papers, which totals about 500 pages. And part of your role was you had to go through it all and make sure the science was right.
Yes. Over the last few months, I've read a lot of papers. I've helped write various sections in various papers. I've helped structure those papers and put it all together. So yeah, it's been a lot of hard work getting the science out there. With all this publicity in the press, it's almost difficult to remember that actually the science has gone out too, and that science is exciting. We have 23 papers. It's a lot of papers, a lot of work. They all do talk about different aspects of the survey. We have different samples of galaxies, different types of galaxies that all have been analyzed. Mock catalogs were created, so large computer simulations were calculated that then were turned into mock catalogs, so completely artificial realizations of the universe that we could compare against the real one. A lot of hard work, 100 scientists around the world, many groups. We've had so many telecons. Every week we've had telecon after telecon talking about these results, how to analyze them, the nitty-gritty details. I won't miss that.
What? You don't like the web chats?
Oh, it's funny going into lockdown because we're in international cooperation. I've been spending most of my life on Zoom for the past, year or so, more than 1 year.
Oh.
So it's kind of like, I feel like everybody's just kind of caught up to where I'm at.
So what happens with these findings now?
So, the referee reports are coming in for a lot of the papers already. All positive so far. I think everybody appreciates we've done a great job. It's exciting for cosmology. I think other cosmologists should be interested in our results. We've got some very robust measurements out there that say some pretty profound things about the universe. Mm-hmm. And now we all go our separate ways, and a lot of us will be moving on to these next projects. The Dark Energy Spectroscopic Instrument, which is a continuation of the philosophy of the Sloan Telescope, but it's a completely different experiment. It's using a 4-meter diameter primary mirror telescope. It's got a new instrument. It's got 5,000 fibers rather than 1,000 fibers, so it's 20 times faster, which is really exciting because it's rare that in experimental science you get a 20 times, a huge jump in your ability to do the experiment. So that's going to be exciting. To be launched in 2022 is a satellite called Euclid, which will also be producing a large map of the universe. I'm one of four science leads for that mission. That's pretty exciting. By going up above the atmosphere, we can cut down on a lot of the problems or the systematic errors that we've had to correct for EBOS. They just won't be an issue for Euclid. So that will be nice. There are other issues and things, but we won't go into those now. there's a lot to be looking forward to over the next real decade. We will keep going and keep producing these maps and keep analyzing them for cosmology.
But you want people to build on this work, don't you? This is all open, isn't it?
Oh, yes, absolutely. The EBOS data is all public. You can go and download it from one of our web servers. Other scientists will do that. History has shown that most of the science actually to do with one of these data sets comes from people downloading the data after we've made it publicly available and using it to do the sorts of analyses that we haven't even thought of doing ourselves.
Oh.
So there have been a lot of counts of papers, scientific papers, and more papers come out from people downloading the data and doing their own analysis than come out from the team. So that's a really great thing. We've worked hard as a collaboration to make our data available and to make it available in a usable format, which means a lot of time writing documentation, a lot of time getting that data, checking it over, checking the catalogs are all structured correctly. And that's been a lot of hard work. And it's something I think the Sloan Digital Sky Survey has done incredibly well, providing the data and making it available as a resource has become one of the key things that the project does. As scientists, we have to analyze the data in time that our analyses come out with the data release. The data release doesn't stop for us. The data just gets made public, and we, as the collaboration, have to analyze it in time.
I think that's great. I think it's great that it's open and that you want people to examine things that you didn't have the opportunity to look at.
Oh, absolutely. And people will go away and they will replicate our analysis. And that's another key thing that's, very good to do in science. You make your data available and people can go away and they can test and they can check that what you've done was right and your interpretation of the data is right. And I think that's very important.
Now, this work represents the culmination of 15 years of your work. For the researchers who are listening, what is that like?
Well, you start off as a young man and you end up middle-aged 15 years later, I'll tell you that. It hasn't really sunk in that we finished with EBOS, possibly because I'm still doing interviews on it and we'll be carrying on. There'll be a tail in our analysis of the data, there are a couple of papers still to come that didn't quite make the deadline. But yeah, it is exciting. I would say to graduate students, particularly, keep working on it. It's easy to get buried in the data and, you know, your code and exactly what you're doing. It's only when your paper comes out that you can actually sit back and maybe realize actually what you've done is that exciting, that so many people in the world are interested in it. And that is really nice to see.
How do you feel that it's done?
It's a mix of emotion, right? I'm pleased that it's complete. I'm pleased that we did a good job analyzing it. I'm pleased that we got all of the papers, most of the papers together to go out. I'm pleased that we wrote the press release in time and the videos were finished the day before they came out. So that was all good and it all came together in the end. So that's great. I don't want this to sound like an Oscar acceptance speech, but I would like to thank particularly Mike and Ophelia Lazaridis for providing the money that gave me the chair that meant I could move to Waterloo, which is a great place to do work. I'd like to thank the press teams, both at the University of Waterloo and the Perimeter Institute. They've done a fabulous job guiding me through the last couple of days and working with me on this. And huge thanks to everybody in EBOS. I mean, you have all done a phenomenal job if you're listening to this.
Well, you know what? We'll have to make sure that they get to hear it.
I will be a little bit sad in a few days' time that it's finished. And I'll be sad, actually, that I'm not talking almost daily to all of the team and we're not having that interaction that we were having. But there is coming online, as I say, these great experiments. They are taking the next step forward. So personally, I'm just going to work at getting my teeth into those two projects that I talked about, the Dark Energy Spectroscopic Instrument in Euclid, and moving on.
Well, good luck with them, and congratulations on this, Will Percival. Thank you so very much for being here.
Thank you.
Well, that about wraps it up for us this week. You can find additional information and links about the items we mentioned in today's episode in the show notes on soundcloud.com. To ensure you don't miss an episode, subscribe to the Beyond the Bulletin podcast there or wherever you get your podcasts and recommend us to your colleagues.
Yes, please do. And please keep washing your hands often with soap and water and practice physical distancing of at least 2 meters.
And mask up when headed indoors in public spaces.
If you'd like to provide feedback or give us an interview idea, please get in touch with us via email at bulletin@uwaterloo.ca.
Thanks for listening as we went Beyond the Bulletin.
How many masks do you have, Brandon?
I believe I have 2. But I can't tell them apart. They're both black, so it could be the same one that I misplace and then rediscover.